Welcome to the Phoenix Cast, a podcast about cybersecurity, technology, and innovation issues in the military. We are your hosts, John.
And Kyle.
I'm a U.S. Marine, and the opinions expressed on the cast are my own, not official military policy.
And the opinions expressed by me are my own, not those of my employer or any other businesses I happen to be associated with.
For today's episode, we're joined by special guest, Lieutenant Colonel Erica Teichert. Could you give us a quick intro?
Hi, John. Hi, Kyle. My name is Lieutenant Colonel Erica Teichert. I am a Guardian in the United States Space Force. I am a 2005 Naval Academy graduate and was commissioned into the Marine Corps. I spent 16 years as a communications officer before transferring to the Space Force in January of 2022. I came over as a space operations officer and then will probably spend a little bit of time as a cyberspace officer in the Space Force as well. Thanks for having me.
So I just want to call out very quickly that I do believe this is the first Space Marine that we have had on the podcast. And this is a big moment for me personally, as someone who always wanted to be a Space Marine. So Erica, I'm super stoked to have you on and looking forward to learning a bunch from you today.
Yeah, it should also be mentioned, because we're all about the same age here. Erica is really living out our childhood dream, as all of us grew up on the movie Aliens. Kyle will give us a nice YouTube clip in the show notes, but there were Space Marines and Aliens, and I'm fairly certain everybody about our age grew up with that as a shaping and pivotal movie. There are those that say that it was Top Gun that was the most influential movie for our generation. I say Aliens. There's your already hot take for the day.
Absolutely.
So Erica, you started as a commo and transitioned to be a Guardian. Could you talk to us about what contributed to that decision for you?
Sure. So it's always been something I've been interested in, the space domain specifically. And as a commo, I really liked I gravitated toward the satellite communications and radio frequency side of our job, less so the data and networking side. Obviously we had to be well-rounded, but the RF side is kind of somewhere that I gravitated towards. And then I was lucky enough to go to the Naval Postgraduate School in 2014 through 2016, and then got a master's degree in space systems operations, and then did my educational payback at Headquarters Marine Corps, doing strategy, budget, policy, Marine Corps integration into the space domain. And then I also helped with the initial working groups for United States Space Command, the reestablishment of U.S. Spacecom, and then the initial task force that laid the foundation for some of the work for U.S. Space Force. So I went back and forth from the space world as a Marine. And then when they opened up the Space Force for inter-service transfers in 2021, I put in my package and was accepted and have been a Guardian I have been a guardian for, 6 months at this point, and have been working for the Space Force for the past year. It's been kind of a crazy adventure, but I'm enjoying being a Space Marine, I'll be excited to see what comes in the next couple of years. So,
all right, I've got a bunch of follow-ups here. So, okay. First one on the NPS, was that something that you got to choose, or was that kind of like a Harry Potter sorting hat style decision?
Yeah. So I got selected when they, I don't know what they're doing now, right? But I got board selected to go to NPS on the education board.
CLEB or CPIB, depending on which one.
It was CLEB.
Okay.
I got CLEB.
Yep.
And then I put Space Ops as my first choice. And got it. And then, spent two phenomenal years at Monterey, doing, some awesome work. The NPS is a phenomenal opportunity for the Marines who are listening, hopefully, if you get the chance, take it. And I think with the C-Club and C-PIB boards, right, what we're seeing is that the promotion rates for Marines who are actually selected on C-Club and C-PIB are actually, the Marine Corps is doing better by the C-Club and C-PIB Marines out there than we were when it wasn't necessarily a board selected process.
Yeah. So to kind of double click or emphasize that, I remember going through both as a captain and a major for both of those boards, and sure. NPS for our generation, because it was C-Club and C-PEB was not a thing for those a couple years ahead of us. They didn't select people for school. Everybody's deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan. And you kind of like, you're like, okay, I've done 2-3 deployments in a row. Give me a break. And they'd cut you orders to school. It wasn't a selected process. You just asked for it and you went. So then about our generation came through and it was about time for us to go to school. And they decided to stand up these boards to do it. And I remember distinctly talking to peers, especially those that got NPS, because there was a stigma. It was like, hey, most commos and you know, smarter people wanting to continually invest in their education kind of felt like they were getting command taken away from them. Because when you look at, you're going to go to a school for 2 years, and then depending, you're going to have like a 4-year payback. That's 6 years. So you're completely taken out of your rank and kind of traditional development in that time. So there, it was seen as an awful lot of risk. And a lot of people thought they wouldn't get selected for command if they got NPS. What we're finding as we now get to this age is that that was misplaced anxiety. But it was definitely a thing at the time. So yeah. Glad to hear you saying that it was a good positive experience. And thanks for recommending that to others.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's like anything else in the Marine Corps, right? It's the bloom where you're planted, and excel in any circumstance, right? And so you can do things at NPS and at your payback that make you a much more valuable Marine, and ideally for our community, a much more valuable communicator. And I will tell you that my education at NPS made me a much better commo on the back end of that. It's obviously the program and the education and the what you put into it, but that's like anything else in our careers, right? So it was a career changing opportunity for me.
And acronym check, C-Club and C-PIB, that would be the Commandant's Career Level Education Board, which is the board that looks at captains, and C-PIB, Commandant's Professional Intermediate Level Education Board, and that would be for majors.
Thank you on behalf of people who may not have any idea what that was.
Yeah, you still have these things right at the top of your head at all times?
I don't. I'm sorry. I was never a captain or a major, so you know, this is all I'm learning as we go.
All right. Fine, I'll excuse you. Okay, so next. Cybercom and SOCOM are combatant commands, just like SpaceCom is, but they are not their own force. Can you talk through for the listeners how you feel this kind of is or is not different? Because this is one of those things where I'm not sure if it's necessarily intuitive or understood, like maybe why this would be, and would love to hear your take on it.
Sure. I think, so let's start with SOCOM, and then I'd like to get rid of SOCOM, the discussion, because I think SOCOM is just one of those, it's weird, right? So SOCOM is a combatant command with service-like authorities, right? So SOCOM has the money and the resources and the law to organize, train, and equip its own people and then employ them the way it wants, right? So the definition of a service, or by law, what a Title 10 service is the ability to organize, train, and equip your people, right? So like the, like the Marine Corps, like the Navy, Army, whatever, has the responsibility to figure out how it wants to organize its own force, the units that it has, its ability to train, its ability to equip. SOCOM has all those weird things that no other combatant command really has, right? So it's always weird when we compare SOCOM to anything else, because we fought this battle, you know, what do we look like? Is SpaceCom going to look like SOCOM and how do we do that? And it's just, SOCOM is just so weird. And I've never done a SOCOM tour. So there's probably someone who can explain the way that SOCOM actually operates. And that's not me. But when we were looking at SpaceCom, we did compare it to SOCOM and figure out if that's the right model. And SOCOM is just so different that, I don't think it doesn't work for what we were trying to do for SpaceCom, at least with CyberCom. And I think, you know, the collective cyberspace operations officers and folks who have worked at Mar4 Cyber and, can probably better explain this also, but CyberCom and the NSA marriage are just so ingrained. And I think that when we looked at CyberCom, especially, the ability to extract cyber things from everything we do is just so difficult that I'm not sure that we'll ever get to a true dedicated cyber force, right? That the cyberspace workforce is just so ingrained in everything we do that you can't extract that, right? With Space Force and SpaceCom, right? So let's talk about what Space Force does and what SpaceCom does, right? So Space Force is the Title 10 warfighting, Title 10 service that organizes, trains, and equips space forces to present to a combatant command. Right now, primarily, those forces get presented to United States Space Command as the warfighting function, right? As the warfighting geographic combatant command, right? So SpaceCom is responsible for the domain of space that's anything that's higher than 100 kilometers, right? And we're talking 100 kilometers to the lunar surface at this point, right? So when you hear things like cislunar, there are elements of the Space Force that's looking at the space domain that we currently think of it as, and then how and to the future, what does it look like, you know, in 100 years or 50 years? Where does the lunar surface come into that? Because you'll hear that there's a $1 trillion economy between here and the lunar surface. And so that's some of the things that Space Command is looking at. So right now, Space Force has a component command assigned to Space Command right now. And we're currently working on what component commands from Space Force look like from, you know, to Central Command, Indo-Pacific Command. We're just not there yet. It's part of the evolution that is Space Force. So I realize that that's kind of a really long, drawn out answer to a fairly short question. Does that help frame Space Force and Space Command?
I think it does, but I want to kick it over to Kyle, who hasn't had to think about this stuff every single day for, I don't know, the last two decades, and ask, does it make sense to you?
Okay, so I'll take this having no practical application about interacting with Space Force or any of the component commands that go within it. But let me try and give an example, right? I'm an old Marine who went to Iraq and Afghanistan, so I'm going to use that. CENTCOM was the organization where when things popped off in certain places, they called all the branches and they said, hey, I need such and such from you, right? I need so many boats from the Navy. I need so many battalions from the Marines. I need all these things to come in and we're going to put together this command to go address this specific theater operation. So, and forgive the tongue-in-cheekness of this, but like if the Martians pop off tomorrow and we really need to go into like a something happens in that 100 kilometer and up range, then should I equate Space Command to CENTCOM? And if that is indeed the case, is that going to be the component and they're going to ask for all the rest of these things? And if the answer to that question is yes, I'm super curious to know how like Mar4 Space falls into that. Is that a thing that gets asked for? Is that a subordinate command of it? Like, help me understand that too, but I guess, so start off with, is CENTCOM essentially SpaceCom? And then how does that ask for troops of any sort and size come?
Okay, so there's a lot there, right? So SpaceCom is a little bit of an oddity, like I think we're starting to see a theme there. So CENTCOM is a very defined geographic boundary. Space Command has that geographic boundary. However, because space is a global domain, there will be a little bit of bleed over that you don't see with some of the true geographic combatant commands. The other thing about Space Command is that they present global effects. And they are also kind of a functional combatant command as well, right? So where you've got Transcom and Cybercom, Spacecom has functional responsibilities that it'll never get rid of, no matter how defined the geographic combatant command is. So where the CENTCOM and Spacecom analogy fits is that geographic combatant command, but where it doesn't fit is that CENTCOM doesn't necessarily have some of those functional responsibilities the way that we see with Cyber Command, right? So let's talk about the functional combatant command responsibilities. So missile warning, you know, so defense of the homeland, where Space Command doesn't necessarily provide defense of, but we do provide missile warning, right? Where Space Force presents forces to either NORTHCOM or SPACECOM, and they provide missile warning capabilities in so that somebody else can provide defense of the homeland, right? So let's talk about Russia and the direct ascent ASAT capability. So Russia just blew up one of their own satellites, right, with a ground to space system, created a ton of debris and made the space domain messier than it already is.
Right.
So Space Force has to equip its forces with the capability of either preventing or deterring, right? So talking about integrated deterrence, the Space Force has to figure out a way of deterring bad actors from doing things in the space domain, right? And then Space Command, their responsibility is actually to employ those capabilities, right? So there is a scenario in there where Space Command is both a supported and a supporting command, right? So we see a lot of times where Space Command will be the supporting command to one of the geographic combatant commands like CENTCOM with EW, electronic warfare capabilities. And then there's a time where potentially Space Command is the supported command, where maybe there's something in CENTCOM that can be offered to SpaceCom to help deter bad actors from doing something in the space domain or that would affect the space domain. That's, I guess, part one, right? Space Command. And then the second one is getting into where does Marine Forces United States Space Command fit into all of this, right? So bringing it back to our potential direct audience, there is a MARFOR space. General Neller signed the establishing document in 2018, I think. And then when General Glavy was commander MARFOR Cyber Command, he was eventually dual-hatted as commander Marine Forces United States Space Command. Ideally, in the future, the Marine Corps will give resources that will be presented to SpaceCom that allow specific Marine Corps functions to be used by U.S. Space Command either to influence or affect the space domain. I see those potentially as being, I think as, you know, as I was mentally preparing this for this, there really can never be too much electronic warfare. And I think in the construct of, expeditionary advanced basing operation type construct that the Marine Corps has, you know, played around with over the last couple of years, I think access is something that the Marine Corps can provide through the MAGTAF and through EABO. And then those electronic warfare teams that MARFOR space potentially can present can help Spacecom in its global fight against a bad actor in whatever geographic or functional area that that the US finds itself fighting in or through or around. Does that help?
I think so.
Yeah, and it also kind of gives us a what could make Marines unique. But the really cool thing about, you know, where you're at and the time you came in, there's not a written manual right now that we've been following for the last 50 years. And we can say, hey, we have succeeded over the last 50 years because we did it exactly like this. Like, that manual is currently being written. Those ideas are kind of being iterated through as we speak. So that's why it's so interesting having you on, because you kind of in this thing at the ground floor at a really interesting time in the history of the both space, you know, Marfor space and Spacecom. Kyle, over to you.
So knowing that we haven't had the doctrine, we haven't had the sort of written down rules of how to do this correctly, because we're sort of all winging this, right? The Space Force is new and Marine support of that is a net new thing also. But do you think that we're getting to a point where there's going to be like an MCDP 90XD9 that comes out that is, you know, Marine support of space operations?
So I think we're almost there. I think that will evolve hopefully fairly quickly. I think that we're starting to see the very beginnings of that with the establishment of the information maneuver occupational field, right? So I think that's what we're calling it, right? Where they're wrapping up the cyberspace ops officers, the influence officers, the maritime space officers. I'm missing at least one in there. But with the MOS establishment, we'll have to figure out how to actually employ these folks. And ideally, it's as a team that presents capability to the MAGTAF and then through the MAGTAF to the joint force, right? So small teams doing niche things, I think is and if you view, you know, if you view even the MU as a small team doing niche things, this is just one element of the MU doing, you know, I, the way I see it in the future is a whatever we would call this this small team doing niche things at the MU level. They're just part of the information warfare center or a, you know, a information maneuver element as part of the MU. And I don't know what exactly that looks like. I don't know if they're a separate, you know, I know the Navy has kind of gone to like an information warfare center. I think the Marine Corps kind of toyed around with doing like another element of the MAGTAF. I don't know if I think we should go there, but I think that that's one way that you could think about this problem.
Yeah, and to name them off real quick, so we already have the 1702 Cyberspace Warfare Officer, and then what is added in is the 1706 Maritime Space Officer, and then the 1707 Influence Officer. And I believe that, as Erica was talking about putting all these niche capabilities together into the MAGTAF, the Marine Air Ground Task Force, I believe that's going to happen at the MEF level, Marine Expeditionary Force, and I think through the MIG, the MEF Information Group. I wonder if I get a dollar if I can put another acronym on top of all of those.
I know, right?
You should try.
Yeah. I think I'm calling it there. But I think that's the current thought process, is that this is going to be given to the MEF through the MIG, and then if you have to have MAGTAFs at a smaller level, then they would be detachments provided from. Or at least that would be the current thinking.
Yeah, which makes sense to me. I think that there's the goodness about a MAGTAF, right, is that it's a and with these niche capabilities, right, it's the Marine who understands marineness, who can talk a little bit of nerdy stuff, and ideally who has a more thorough understanding, maybe not better, you know, just different and more thorough understanding of joint capabilities and can bring that joint capability back to the MAGTAF.
Yeah, that would, I can tell you that would definitely make a huge deal. And there's some level where, and we've kind of at the beginning of starting off the up the podcast, we said, hey, things are starting to get complicated. And we tried to go about simplifying or adding to the conversation. And I think, you know, warfare hasn't really changed at all in that regard either. Like it's, we are not iterating towards simplicity. And there's not a real easy book with, you know, pictures and small words that makes this super simple. So I think to Erica's point of there's so much going on and there's so many niche capabilities, not just inside of the Marine Corps, but also in the joint fight as well, by having a Marine Corps space officer, for instance, and understanding both what the Marine Corps can bring to the fight, but also what the joint community has for us and what all can be leveraged, I'm sure is going to not only have big value, but be near almost completely required to really operate.
So I want to take this to a slightly nerdier angle, right? Like I go through a microservice design as we start talking about this, right? There are APIs upon APIs that are interacting between these different subcomponents, these different microservices, which I'm now going to start calling all small teams doing niche things, just microservice deployments. I don't know. There's a lot of overlap here between absolute DevOps nerdery and Marine component commands that we're talking about. But at the end of the day, we're never going to be able to write a manual that says this is how to conduct operations in June of 2022. You know, the minute we publish an MCDP on how to conduct marine cyber operations that gets into any level of specificity, it's going to be outdated the minute someone hits print. And so that's a never-ending battle. That's Sisyphean, if you will, to try and write that down and say this is the book on how we do it. But my question is, should we be focusing on the API layer, right? We've talked about how joint capability is the differentiating value between how we are going to, and I'm going to use the royal we of the Marine Corps, going to be able to provide support to SpaceCom or to any theater command when it comes to, you know, leveraging the MIGs or leveraging the cyber capabilities that are going to be deployed in any MAGTF operation. If we do it that way, does that make sense to define this is how we are going to do it? Don't define the tools, but here's the procedures about what needs to be shared, right? Here's the general rules of the API, and you can throw any variable or flag that you want at it after that. Is that sort of where we're focusing? Is that where we should be focusing? Or at this point, is there just one API that everyone is going to interact with SpaceCom? Or should there be independent and unique APIs between the Navy, the Marine Corps, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. I feel like we could talk about that one question for, you know, an entire hour, right?
The day is young, Erica.
I know, right? I know.
Dear listeners, we're not going to do that to you, but keep on. Yeah.
I don't know if anybody could put up with that much nerdery, right? I think there's benefit in... I think there's benefit in having that thought exercise, right? Because if we start talking about the how, then it quickly gets into technology, right? But warfighting is just warfighting, right? And I think we've seen that across any domain, right? You have to be able to understand your adversary. You have to be able to, you go through the, engagement, find, fix, track, target, engage, assess cycle, right? The targeting cycle. And that's just warfighting, right? And so there's benefit in, I think, understanding, you know, potential, let's kind of hone in on that, right? So is there benefit, and I think this is kind of where we're going with this, is there benefit in having the Marine Corps understand the F2, T2, EA, the targeting cycle, in and around the space domain and being able to affect the targeting cycle in and around the space domain in the bigger picture in the joint force. And I think understanding that, and I think being able to affect that across the services and in little chunks and in big chunks is important, right?
Yeah. And the other thing I'll kind of put onto this as well is like, and not at all making light or a joke here, space is far away. And what is really difficult, which we've seen looking through is, as Kyle mentioned, DevOps or really any of the things we've talked to through almost every episode, is how close you are to your quote customer. And in this case, we might be able to sub out customer with the warfighter. No matter how good those space capabilities are, if it's so far away that it feels almost not real to you, having a physical presence, probably a thing that'll almost be necessary. And I think we could probably have a good academic discussion over, are we going to do something like provide LNOs from Space Force to the ground troops, or are we going to have, you know, Space Marines that are going to do that, you know, Mar 4 Space Marines that do that, or what's the best way to do that, or should it be both, a combination? That I think is a conversation, but figuring out a way to get those teams close together, because with space being so far, you can't imagine it working any other way.
Yeah. So there's two things that I want to jump in there really quick. So one, there was a guardian assigned to the 31st Mew a couple of years ago. And I think unfortunately she was underemployed. And that's no, you know, I think we were pretty early in the Space Force standup. And so I don't think that they really understood how to employ her. What she ended up doing is GPS plots. And so better fidelity of targeting systems. I think that what she could have done is there's a program. And at this point, the it's been pretty far declassified. So it's kind of fun to be able to talk about it, especially to commos. There's a program called Bounty Hunter, and basically what it does is electromagnetic interference overwatch. So it'll monitor all of your comm systems and then tell you when there's interference on the system, where that's blue on blue, gray on blue, red on blue. And it's a phenomenal program, phenomenal system manned by some phenomenal guardians. And I think that Marine Corps commos have underemployed that capability wholesale. So that was one. And then the thing that my boss says a lot is that unless you're an astronaut, you don't experience the space domain except through data, right? And so experiencing a domain through data, whereas we're so used to experiencing the domains in which we fight through the physical system, we're going to have to understand how to absorb that data and how to understand that data and how to, you know, make sense of all of the information that we're processing, right? So how do you experience something through data when you're used to experiencing something in the physical domain? And that's, it's something that we're fighting through. I think that as cyber guys, you guys, you know, as commos, we kind of understand that, right? Because we don't experience the ones and zeros except for when they appear on our screen, right? And so it's a similar construct, right?
Yeah, I'm just thinking like, thank you, Wireshark. Like Wireshark, right? Was the thing that, you know, you absolutely have the ones and zeros going across the cable and it's kind of like, I know the data is happening, but I don't know. And then you got Wireshark and you're like, oh my God. And it, you see it and be like, wait a minute, what's at layer two? Oh, I'll just click there and find that. What's at layer three? Ooh, I'll click there and find that out. Yep. And it's like, what can I read plain text just happen? Like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So if you can just go ahead and make Wireshark for space, that would be super.
Right.
And I would like to, you know, using Kyle's favorite, let's click and add to cart.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think the reconnaissance in general has been really interesting as a communications focused person, right? And as we get into cybersecurity, that gets even more deep, because not only you can't go those places, you have to know where your signals are, where you're actually listening in on. Can you even trust that data, et cetera, et cetera. Now, let's not only take that away from, you know, being speed of light on the planet and terrestrial away, but now let's talk about things that are distant by, you know, hundreds of kilometers, where those signals that are coming in, again, can you trust them, and how much faith can you put inside of that? Where are you listening from? How are you listening, et cetera? It becomes a very multifaceted problem.
Absolutely.
I dare say literal 3D chess.
Yeah, probably.
We use that a lot, but this is like one of those situations where it actually applies.
Yeah. I would, the time dimension too adds in a whole other layer of, things are traveling extremely fast up there. And so the reaction time, if you want to bring in, automated, you know, automated systems, artificial intelligence, machine learning, you know, things in low Earth orbit are traveling 17,500 miles per hour, right? And then things from the ground to space, depending on where in space, it's not long. And so I think some of our collective experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, where you were waiting for, name it, minutes, hours, waiting for clearance for fires, right? Like, you may not have that time in cyberspace, in the space domain. What does clearance of fires look like when your timescales are milliseconds, or, you know, or maybe hours, depending if it's a physical weapon. But if it's a non-kinetic, whatever we're calling non-kinetic weapons at this point, if it's milliseconds, what does that look like, right? And so I think it's a fascinating time to be in this business. And we'll see what happens in terms of people's comfort levels and clearance of fires.
Yeah, that the fires process, that will get fascinating very quickly. I look forward to someone else solving that problem. So you mentioned a fascinating time, and I wanted to kind of close us out on a little bit less nerdy and on a more kind of interpersonal note. So you're coming into a new organization, which from a culture standpoint, I would imagine the civilian world can kind of understand and comprehend this, but maybe they don't. The military doesn't change that quickly. So when we have a real new, that is a real cultural opportunity or challenge, if you want to look at it that way. And you're coming in to a new organization as a relatively senior leader. So have you thought through it all, setting the tone for culture? Has that been presented to you, or is this a problem that you are going to solve? Where's your head at on this one?
Yeah. So, when I did, when the inter-service transfer process was opened up for non-Air Force folks, so people coming into the Space Force from the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps, it was almost an imperative from the Space Force folks to say, we are bringing you in not only for your technical expertise, but for your cultural differences that we can glom onto and figure out what right looks like for the Space Force, right? Because the idea isn't that it's supposed to be a new service, right? So, under the Department of the Air Force lie the United States Air Force and the United States Space Force, like the Department of the Navy owns the Marine Corps and the Navy, right? And so the Navy and the Marine Corps have a very different culture that's evolved over the last 200 years. The idea is that the Space Force will evolve into its own unique service culture. And so some of the things that I think that we have been that Marines specifically have, and I would say some, our Army, our Army brothers and sisters are also kind of charged with bringing into the Space Force is that warfighting culture. It's understanding the fires process. It's understanding what it looks like to be a Marine 24/7, right? So there are guardians on watch 24/7 around the world, but a lot of them have been kind of doing a service provider mentality, and a lot of them are having to shift focus into a warfighting mentality where what they do affects not only, soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen, but also every American every day, right? Every American, unlike most of the services, other services, Americans use the Space Force on a daily basis, right? Every time you pick up your phone, you're using a capability that's provided by the United States Space Force, and that's the global positioning system, right? So that little blue dot that tells you to go from point A to point B on your phone, that's a service provided by the United States Space Force. So the type of understanding of the impact of what you are doing on a daily basis, I think Marines kind of have an inherent force and readiness that we have been charged with bringing to this new service. And so that's one thing that I think I hope to bring to the Guardians I'm privileged to serve with in the future. And so it has been kind of an interesting time for me. because of where I am in my job right now, I actually haven't been to what, you know, whatever we would call the quote unquote fleet, in the Space Force. And so it'll be interesting for me to take what I've learned over the past year as a guardian, but more importantly, over the past 17 years, as a service member, right? And so 16 years as a Marine, I don't necessarily know exactly what I'm going to bring. And that's kind of fun, right? There's a little bit of a joy and an excitement there that, it'll be interesting to see where my perspective differs and where I can learn and also contribute to the Guardians I'm going to get to serve with.
So I have one follow-up kind of in regards to that. So we mentioned at the beginning of the cast, like, hey, we're going to make it nerdy. And I would say even the most simple thing in space is incredibly complicated. Yeah. When I was a commo and I was explaining to people how we were going to get services, and I would get grief about, like, hey, my internet at home goes down less often than what you're doing in the field. And then I would just explain to them the physics behind what is happening to make even the most simple thing work. And I was like, it is a miracle it ever works.
Yes. And when 100%,
you kind of,
yes.
And when you reframe the conversation a little bit like that, it's like, okay. And now that's essentially everything that you do. Yeah. So my question is, do you think there's something culturally that needs to diverge? Or do you think there's something unique about, you know, assuming that space is more challenging and more nerdy, do you think that there's something cultural that needs to be done to kind of help emphasize and reinforce that? Can you celebrate the difference? Or do you think the right thing to do is to try to downplay those differences and make us all seem as one? And then as a leader, how are you going to reinforce that choice?
Yeah, so I think it's probably both, right? And I realize that that's probably the easy answer. I think that the setting ourselves apart is important because it gives Guardians something to hold on to. And I realize things like uniforms and core values aren't something that the average American taxpayer loves to hear about, but they are important because they help Guardians take pride in what they do, right? So the Space Force diverged from the Air Force in the core values. Kind of, so the Marine Corps and the Navy have the same core values, but we define them a little bit differently, right? And so the idea that that the Space Force and Air Force can have its own core, like individual core values, is important, right? Kyle, you wanna, yeah?
Yeah, I'll also say this. While the American taxpayer may not see that those things are important, let me just explain something very critical. And I think all of our listeners will probably understand this, right? Guess what the Marines do? The same thing that every other branch of service does, but we are better, right? And the reason we are better, right? I'm just going to throw this out. The reason we are better is because we put more stock into that culture, more stock into being the best, feeling pressure to be the best, striving to be the best, and having our, you know, our core values and our dedication toward the mission be first. There is absolutely nothing in the world wrong with focusing a lot of effort on defining what your core values are going to be as part of Space Force or Space Command and developing that internal culture. That may be an unsexy thing for taxpayers, but holy crap, is it important. And if you just want to see what you get when you invest in that, go look at the Marine Corps versus any other branch right now and just tell us which one you think has better culture. So just please keep investing in that. Don't let the influence of the taxpayer on that particular mission stop you at all.
No, I think I think you're absolutely right. There's a lot that goes into that. There's a lot of understanding what it means to be a guardian, right? And I think when I, as Marines, I think we, you hear when people ask what you do, right? I am a Marine, right? So I'm a guardian in the United States Space Force, and it's not that I work for the Space Force, and there's a little bit of a difference there. And I'm not, and I would say that, maybe this is sacrilege in the Marine Corps world. There's a little bit of a balance there, right? It's, you don't want necessarily the blind adherence to the institution, but you want to you want people to have ownership in the institution, right? And there's a difference there, right? So how do you invest in culture? How do you invest in uniforms? How do you invest in the core values in a way that gives people ownership in the institution without becoming completely
robotic?
Let's say constrained by it.
Sure,
because,
absolutely.
Like, let's be honest. It's 2022, and whatever Erica has in her mind, and all of your bosses, that space is going to end up being, that ain't the right answer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so, like, I think probably the best thing that we can do is build in some mental flexibility.
Absolutely.
And to allow us to iterate quickly and move towards where we need to go. And probably, you know, you got to be careful with culture. Obviously, there's some, like, you know, irrevocable kind of, like, no stealing, you know, none of the terrible things. So you got to set the right culture of doing the right thing, but getting too culturally locked in at a time of very obvious change is probably a smart call.
Yep.
Yeah. And you see the Space Force trying to do some of those things to allow a little bit of that flexibility for the individual service member, right? So one of the things that the Space Force is trying to do is make it a little bit easier to do part-time versus full-time and going back and forth between those two. And then you see a lot of unique opportunities for talent management and specific guardian focused new ideas that ideally the Space Force will start with and then maybe will perpetuate across the Joint Force.
I love this. So we have had a bunch of awesome dialogue here. I'll give us one last chance for any kind of saved rounds or things that we wanted to get to that maybe we missed. Kyle, was there anything you wanted to add before we finish up?
So, Erica, I have one question. Call it a softball, call it introspective, whatever you want to call it. But knowing that you've been in this Space Force game now for a little while and you were one of the founding members, I'm interested in finding out, what do you think we should have done better in the beginning that we didn't? And how are you using that to sort of influence your decisions going forward as you're sort of adapting on the fly to everything?
So I think one of the themes that we're starting to figure out is that the bureaucracy is real. And there are some, there's a reason for some of it, but it's been a little bit harder than I think anyone thought it was going to be. And then trying, and if you think about it, so Space Force was established December of 2019. What happens 3 months later? Mm-hmm. A global pandemic, right? And so basically, since the establishment of the United States Space Force, we have been operating under the constraints of a global pandemic. And so when 25% of your, you know, workforce that's already tiny, so, you know, think about it, the biggest that the Space Force will probably be, at least in the near future, is 8,400 active duty or, you know, service members, and then about the same number of civilians, right? So the largest that the Space Force will be is less than 20,000, right? Think about, you know, and so when a quarter of your workforce, when only a quarter of your workforce can show up to work at any given point, who's doing all is so doing all of the things that you need to do to establish a service and a culture and, you know, any number of things, doctrine, uniforms, whatever, under the constraints of a global pandemic has just been extremely difficult. So can I change that? No, I can't change that. Is it probably going slower than folks would like? Yeah, probably. But you got to think about that in context and realizing, like, it just is what it is. So it's going to be crazy. It's going to continue to be crazy. I kind of anticipate craziness for the foreseeable future. And it's kind of awesome. Like, I kind of love it.
Yeah. And to give context or perspective real quick to Erica's numbers, when I entered the Marine Corps, give or take 2000, the Marine Corps was 170,000 people. And at the height of the Iraq War, it was give or take 202,000 people. To give you an idea of how, and then the Marine Corps is a tiny service comparatively to the rest of the military. So, whew, Yes. Yeah, that is not a lot of people.
No, it's not. The boss joked that there were two services who were grateful when the Space Force got established: the Coast Guard because they were no longer the smallest, and the Air Force because they were no longer the youngest, right? And so, but you see excitement about it. The Space Force had a 40% growth in terms of budget over in FY23. So we'll see how that kind of plays out in the future. But there's you see people's excitement and people starting to realize the necessity of the service in a way that I don't think we saw before the establishment of Space Force.
And Erica, was there any last things you wanted to get in before we wrap?
Sure. I'll say one quick thing. You know, I hope, I don't want this to be a recruiting tool for the Space Force, right? I tell people that I didn't walk away from the Marine Corps. I just walked towards something new and important in a way. And it was a way for me to continue doing space things in a way that I couldn't do in the Marine Corps, but there's a lot of really good stuff going on in the Marine Corps right now. And so if space is something that you're interested in and you can't picture yourself walking away from the Marine Corps, walking towards something else, like look at the information maneuver occupational field. I think there's a lot of growth there. There's a lot of education that the Joint Force can provide to Marines where it'll make you a better Marine, a more effective Marine, and most importantly, a more lethal Marine. And you don't have to be a guardian in the Space Force. So if you see yourself as a Marine, then educate yourself in the space domain and it'll just make you a more lethal Marine. But if you do want to come over to the Space Force, don't be afraid of that either. There's a lot of fun stuff going on in the domain.
Kyle, it is that time. Hit us with your hot take.
So we've talked about a lot of stuff here, and I think this has been an interesting podcast to explore, an entirely new branch of the armed forces. And I want to quote Douglas Adams for a quick second here, because it feels appropriate given the shenanigans of our podcast in some way, shape, or form, because it's going to lead into kind of my hot take, right? And space is big. Really big. You won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the road to the PX, but that's just peanuts to space. And so when you're dealing with the problems of time or distance or speed in your day job, those are independently hard, right? But when all of them are constantly working in unison to obfuscate what's actually happening in each and every microsecond, that is an unyielding, grueling, demanding level of difficulty to try and master, and to do it with, a few thousand humans. So say what you want and feel how you want to feel about the newest branch of the armed forces in the Space Force, but this is a massively critical duty in the defense of our nation. And I'm super stoked personally to have leaders like Erica taking charge and helping evolve and adapt within that battle space so that the other branches of the armed forces can be better in theirs. So there's my hot take.
Dear listeners, thank you for joining us. You can connect with us on social media by going to Twitter and following @USMC_TFPHOENIX. That's @USMC_TaskForcePhoenix. Our editor is Sarah Clarkson, and marketing support is provided by Jake Osborne. You can support the cast by going to Apple Podcasts and leaving us a 5-star review, which you have not been doing, and accompanying comment, which you should also do. And we are out.